All right, here we go in 3, 2, 1. What's up, y'all? Welcome to the Sports Medicine Broadcast, Shoulder Anatomy. We're talking about tips, tricks, and reviews, and then we're going to talk about just some weird things that we've seen just as we work to improve our understanding and evaluation of the shoulder anatomy. So I've got Marcus Knox, physical therapist for Memorial Hermann, also a Rice University graduate. I'm sorry.
Oh, man, I'm from Methodist. Hold on.
Yeah, hold on. Okay, so we got Marcus Knox. Let me switch over to his camera there if you're watching live. Marcus Knox. He's got his Methodist shirt on.
Methodist. Yep. But he looks good behind in front of that backdrop, though.
Oh, come on now.
And then we got Bubba.
Recruiting tactic.
Oh, my goodness. Now we got Bubba Wilson from Memorial Hermann over there. And as the athletic trainer, also he's been on here quite a few times. So I am, of course, Jeremy Jackson, host of the Sports Medicine Broadcast. And then Google Hangouts video call, we got Matthew Frericks. It's like Fredericks without the D, right? So Matthew Frericks. Did I say that right, Matthew?
Yeah, you did.
There we go. Good. this conversation is sportsmedicinebroadcast.com. Again, sportsmedicinebroadcast.com/shoulder anatomy. You could tell that I've been absent for like 3 days, huh? I'm just not with it. All right, so as we're talking about shoulder anatomy, we're going to kind of go over a view, talk about what's here. We're going to talk about tips, tricks for kind of finding those things, identifying those things, and then just, again, weird things that we have seen. And then over the next two podcasts, we're going to talk about evaluation and rehabilitation. So without much further ado, Marcus, you got a lot of notes in here. And Bubba, of course, you know how this works. And then Matthew, anytime you got questions, comments, concern, something to add, just jump right in there. So, Marcus, why don't you start us off?
All right, so we're going to start with the actual bones of the shoulder. So what is the shoulder actually made of? So we have the humerus, okay? We have the scapula, a.k.a. the shoulder blade, and then we have the clavicle, collarbone. So all three of those are going to join and actually make the shoulder. Now, as far as joint-wise, you have three joints. I like to say maybe four because I just kind of throw in a bonus one. You know, you have your glenoid humeral joint. You have your acromioclavicular joint, sternoclavicular joint, and like I said, kind of throw in a little bonus one, the scapulothoracic joint. So I kind of throw that one in because it's very important as far as mobility and stability of the actual shoulder, and we're always going to kind of address that when we're addressing the actual shoulder, any kind of shoulder pain.
I would argue it's a joint.
I would totally agree.
And you could argue patella femoral is not technically a joint either, but it's considered a joint.
True, and it's something that definitely would need to be addressed. So we're just going to say four joints then. We'll just kind of go like that. All right. As far as the muscles, I kind of divided up into three different kind of groups here. Now, most people just say, hey, you know, you got your rotator cuff muscles and your deltoid muscles, and that's technically, you know, all the shoulders and the muscles. But there's actually a lot of different muscles. I'm just going to kind of touch on 13 of them. Some of them, like the people say, there's more, maybe kind of 22 if you want to throw in, you know, triceps and things like that. But these main parts of the muscles of the shoulder, they kind of, we can kind of go into that. The first one, I'd say, is more the thoracoscapular groups of muscle. That's going to cover your traps, your levator scap, your rhomboids, your serratus anterior, and your pec minor. So with this group here, we can kind of go through, you know, kind of what they do. Now, you know, we have the traps, and we have the upper trap, middle trap, lower trap. The upper trap is going to be in charge of actually elevating the shoulder blade, as well as upwardly rotating the shoulder blade as well. Your mid trap is going to help with actually retraction of the scapula, while your lower trap is going to be more of a depressor and upward rotator of the scapula, and they're all supposed to work in conjunction with one another. It tends to be that the upper trap is more active, and if you look at it as far as a muscle imbalance and they're all working together, that upper trap seems to be more active with people with shoulder issues, and the lower trap is not active or very weak. So we tend to try to equal out that balance, that muscle imbalance, when we're treating the shoulder. We could talk about the levator scapula. It's going to help, you know, adduct and downwardly rotate the scapula. The rhomboids, they're going to adduct as well, and they're going to help with downward rotation. Your serratus is going to actually abduct the shoulder blade, and it's going to help with upward rotation. And it's also key because it's going to stabilize the scapula as well, against the actual thorax, or the, you know, thoracic part of the spine there, or the ribs really. And then we have your pec minor. Pec minor, you can kind of see if it's actually supposed to tilt the scapula anteriorly, and you're going to see a lot of you know, you see the athletes with the rounded shoulders, and you know, the chest muscles are a lot tighter, and their back muscles are a little bit more spread out. So if you have anybody that's kind of winging as well, that's mainly because that pec minor is actually tilting that scapula a little bit more anterior than it really should be. We'll touch on a little bit later the really good importance, the importance of the motion of the shoulder blade and its relationship with the shoulder, and how it can actually cause more issues with it if it's not on the same page with the shoulder. Second group of muscles, we have the thoracohumeral joint, muscles group. That's considered your lats. Your lats are going to actually help adduct. They're going to help extend the shoulder, and they're going to help with internal rotation, okay? Pec major is going to help with adduction of the shoulder. It's going to help with flexion and also internal rotation, excuse me. Finally, you have your scapulohumeral groups of muscle. That's going to be your deltoids, right? You got your anterior, your middle, and your posterior deltoids, supraspinatus, infraspinatus, you know, kind of rotator cuff muscle, subscap, teres minor and major, right? As far as teres minor and major, they're going to help with, well, teres minor is going to help with external rotation, and it's also going to kind of help with the actual glenohumeral stability of the shoulder. Your teres major is going to help with internal rotation, and actually helps with extension and adduction of the actual shoulder. Subscapularis is going to also help kind of depress the shoulder blade. It's going to help with internal rotation, and it's going to help extend the humerus as well. Your infraspinatus is going to help with depression. Depression and external rotation, and also extension of the humeral head. And then, of course, your supraspinatus is going to also help with abduction, depression, and then externally rotate the humerus as well. Finally, we have your deltoids. You know, the anterior portion of the deltoids are going to help with abduction, flexion, and internal rotation, while the middle part is going to help with abduction of the humerus. And then the posterior aspect will be doing abduction, extension, and external rotation. So these groups of muscles, they all need to be working together, kind of like, you know, transmission of a car, you know, shifting from gear 1 to gear 2 to gear 3, and it needs to be a nice, smooth transition. So when one group of muscles, like, for example, the upper trap, is doing a little bit too much activation, it can throw off the actual mechanics of the shoulder. In between, there's a small space, the subacromial space. It's a very small space, so there's a lot of things going on there. I mean, you got the bursa, if you got tendons from the supraspinatus, and a lot of other things going along in that shoulder. So if you can imagine, if the shoulder blade is not moving correctly, it's going to put a lot more pressure on those, you know, tendons and different things like that. That's how you get your chronic rotator cuff tears that, you know, nobody's really hurting themselves, you know, as far as a mechanism of injury, but over time they'll have that a rotator cuff tear because they're micro tearing that tendon over and over again due to impingement, okay? As far as the muscles here, that's pretty much a wrap up with
those.
All
right, Bubba, I saw you jotting down some notes. You got some questions or comments there, Bubba?
I will, not now.
Okay.
I think one of the things that's probably left out from a muscle standpoint, and you've got it sitting there, which is biceps itself, which is a humeral head depressor.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I mean, that the muscle belly itself, fibers, is not in the shoulder joint, mm-hmm, as we know it, but it's a pretty important piece of anatomy in there, and I think you're fixing to touch on it. But I'm going to go ahead and jump to it. I lied, Jeremy. One of the things you were talking about is that rounded shoulder thing, and so your upper traps are overactive.
Mm-hmm.
Your anterior muscles, your chest muscles are overdeveloped, overactive, and you look like the big muscle-bound guy that can't function because you are a big muscle-bound guy that can't function.
True.
And so anybody that's an overhead athlete is already at a mechanical disadvantage, plus they're at a functional disadvantage.
Mm-hmm.
So you're a guy that, you know, they like their mirror lifts, you know, bench press, bicep curls, those things. And we've talked about it before, and we're going to talk about it within this, I'm sure. And I know I'm jumping the gun a little bit, but I think it's important. When you talk about all these things having to work in conjunction, and there's, you know, scapulothoracic rhythm and all these other aspects that go with this, is in the weight room, in the athletic training room, in the physical therapy clinic, these things that have to be done to balance is a 2-to-1, two mm-hmm. pulls to one push minimum.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of people, I can't say forget it, they overlook it. Because if I can't bench press and I can't be an athlete in theory, which we know is wrong at this table at least.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that's, as we go through this, something to just keep in mind. You know, we don't do enough work on the posterior side at the upper extremity level or the lower extremity level. And so hopefully 2 weeks from now, as we talk about some of that, a lot of our focus will be in that area.
I totally agree with you on that, because it really boils down to that ratio of the scapula and the humeral joint, like you said. So it's really actually a 2-to-1 ratio. So every 2 degrees that the the humerus is moving, for example, flexion, you're going to get 1 degrees
right.
of actual abduction from the scapula. So if you already have a disadvantage because it's anatomy-wise in the wrong place due to upper trap or cross, you know, upper
right.
cross syndrome,
right.
you're already, like you said, put yourself in a functional disadvantage. And then that we need that scapular mobility to actually properly upperly rotate, and those muscles are throwing everything off. You're putting a lot more tension on that humeral head and those tendons. So
right, if I'm an overhead athlete with rounded shoulders, I can't function
exactly
as I need to. As I steal from Dr. Meister, his analogy is probably the best. The better I can cock the gun, the better I can fire the bullet.
Exactly.
And if I can't externally rotate to the extreme, a safe extreme, then I'm at a disadvantage of firing the bullet,
mm-hmm.
doing whatever I'm doing, upper extremity. Be that throwing a ball, serving, you know, hitting a volleyball, throwing a ball, hitting a serve with a racket, mm-hmm. swimming,
yeah,
right? Whatever it is, I can't do it because I can't create enough forward force because I don't have enough time lever arm-wise to bring it forward. So.
Exactly. And that kind of – it makes the importance of why we do functional screens, because we want to see if we can catch those type of things and kind of address them before they end up being a problem.
That's a whole other topic.
Yeah, that's
– All right, Matthew. So what'd you got so far, Matthew?
Well, kind of what Bubba was already alluding to. Marcus already went over the anatomy and then kind of everything. I was already thinking Bubba kind of already touched on it. Kind of like looking – kind of like the overlooked parts is kind of what I see a lot. And that goes with like just a lot of professions, is a lot of people just look at like what you alluded to is the posterior part. Like what I see a lot of people is like, oh, they just focus on the pecs and the biceps mm-hmm. and they totally forget about everything else. And that's when obviously we know sitting here is like, that's when a lot of stuff can start to come on, when they're only focused on that one part. So basically everything I was already thinking, Bubba already kind of touched on.
All right, Marcus.
Okay, so we'll kind of go into the tendons. We already kind of touched on it. Bicep tendon, you have its two heads. You have a long head and you have a short head. The actual long head is going to kind of connect to the superior glenoid labrum. Then your short head is going to connect to the coracoid process. Supraspinatus tendon, that's going to be inserted in the superior facet of the actual greater tubercle of the humerus. So that's one of these tendons that's going to go through that subacromial space. And as we already kind of touched on, if that scapula is in the wrong angle or it's not moving like it needs to, that's going to cause, it is really not a lot of space going through that subacromial, and there's a lot of stuff. So there's stuff that's already in there. I mean, you got the bursa and things like that. So you're already putting yourself at a disadvantage just functionally. And then as far as anatomy-wise and injury prevention type things, you're going to increase your chances of injury, especially with impingement, just kind of chronic impingement. You also have the subscapularis. That's going to insert more in the tubercle of the humerus and the kind of more the front part of the capsule of the shoulder joint. Your infraspinatus is actually going to travel more at a diagonal and kind of inserts more on the greater tubercle of the humerus. Your teres minor, that's going to kind of connect to the greater tubercle of the humerus. And all these muscles, they're crisscrossing each other. And if you actually look at where they're inserting, you can kind of see what they're already going to do, what their job is going to do. So if we have one muscle, like for example, the lats, they're coming from the lower part of the back, and they're going to cross actually in front of the actual humerus and connect to the front. So if you look at it as a lever, it's going to actually pull that arm into internal rotation, right? So just kind of paying attention on where all of these, you know, insertions and origins of these muscles and tendons, you can kind of already see. If you have to kind of take, you know, kind of dissect the shoulder and just look at the actual single muscle and tendon, you can see what that actual function is of that, you know, muscle and tendon. I think the next one we're talking about was ligaments.
All right. Bubba, you got anything else over there?
I'll wait till after ligaments because I do, but
okay,
it all ties in.
Okay, ligament-wise, we have the coracohumeral ligaments. There's actually three of them. There's a superior, there's a middle, and there's an inferior. It's actually shaped, and when all three of them are, you know, of course, working together, they're actually going to be shaped anatomy-wise in the kind of the letter Z. They are taut at external rotation, and they have some laxity in there when there's internal rotation. But as far as testing, and we'll kind of touch on it next week as far as with the evaluation of the shoulder, we can talk about how they're actually tested. Superior coracohumeral ligament is going to be more in charge of external rotation and keeping the stability of the shoulder when it's more kind of at 0 degrees. And then you kind of go to the middle coracohumeral ligament, that's going to be more important, more kind of at 45 degrees. So the way these fibers are laid and where they're actually inserted is going to protect the shoulder at different angles and things like that. Okay. Is everything still good? Technical difficult.
All right, so the computer just crashed for the live stream, but the podcast is still going. So
okay.
All right. Cool. Keep going and it'll hopefully come back up.
All right, perfect. You also have the coracoclavicular ligament that's going to be pretty much divided into the coronoid. It's going to limit the separation between the clavicle and the scapula. And you also have the trapezoid ligament that's going to connect the clavicle with the coracoid ligament. There's another ligament, it's the coracoacromial, but it really doesn't have too much movement, but it's just kind of more of a stabilizer of the actual shoulder. All right, so then we'll kind of touch on the labrum. The labrum is going to be surround the glenoid fossa. Now, the glenoid fossa is part of the shoulder blade, so it's actually a very smaller concave surface. But if you look at how the glenoid fossa has to relate to the humeral head of the shoulder, I mean, the humeral head of the shoulder surface area is a lot larger. So, I mean, to a certain extent, I'm not going to say that this is the correct ratio, but it's pretty much like having a golf ball on top of a tee. It's a very small, the golf tee is going to be very small, you know, as far as the glenoid fossa, and then you have the humeral head that's sitting on top or connecting to that glenoid fossa. So it's very small area that's being touched on from the humeral head, and it's being supported by the labrum. Okay, the labrum is actually kind of like the meniscus of the knee. It's going to help with stabilization. The inferior part of the actual labrum is a little bit more tougher. It's kind of more inelastic. And then versus the superior part, which is going to have a little bit more flexibility. I mean, you got your bicep tendon that's going to kind of connect up there as well. And any kind of injury to the labrum, for example, you have a labral tear, it's going to interrupt the interarticular pressure. Okay, so just imagine there's a negative pressure that's kind of keeping that humeral head in the glenoid fossa. And then as soon as you tear that labrum, it's going to pretty much let out that pressure. And then that's when you have that instability within the shoulder. Right?
And the problem is with with the glenohumeral joint being so shallow and small, even if we repair the labrum, we still lose that suction, that yep. negative pressure. Whereas in the hip, being as deep as it is, mm-hmm. You can have a labral tear and be relatively stable
yep.
in a grand scheme of things, but repair it and become very stable again because you don't, for whatever reason, we're not losing that the pressures at the same amount. Mm-hmm. And so, well, and we'll touch on it again, but you know, a lot of the stuff out of Dr. Andrews and those guys is talking about, you know, if you're not a major league pitcher and you get a scope put in your shoulder, they don't even have to repair anything. You got about a 0% chance of becoming a major league pitcher just because we've disrupted
that vacuum
in there. And so we can never get it back.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can't put a vacuum hose mm-hmm. in there and suck it out and seal it. It just doesn't work. And so, you know, I've got a labral tear. I've got to get it fixed. Okay, you're better off getting it fixed potentially, but you still may never be at the level you mm-hmm. were at previously.
Yeah, so. I just recently had a patient that they chose not to have their surgery, and of course, it's the labrum is not very vascular, so it's going to take time for it to heal. So the best thing that we were kind of doing is just working on different parts of the shoulder to give it some stability. In his case, it was his posterior muscles were just weak. Mm-hmm. Right. Range of motion was pretty good, but there's still some internal rotation that was lacking. But we focused more on that posterior strength so we can control what's going on. And just like you were saying, once you cut that open, you're going to lose that pressure. Right.
Well, and you just touched on it. You know, we talked about posterior chain. But if we look at what's the misnomer on Tommy John, I'm going to come back stronger.
Oh, it's because of the shoulder.
You quote unquote come back stronger because you've had a year to a year and a half to address mm-hmm. all the faults that put you on the operating table.
Exactly, in the first place.
You know, you're never as strong as what you're born with unless mm-hmm. you're born without it and they have to go put something in. But, you know, you're working on all your faults and weaknesses. And so, same thing with the shoulder. You know, we can talk about GERD and all these things, mm-hmm. but if the stabilizing structures around that aren't doing their job, then it doesn't matter. You know, it doesn't matter what we do. You know, if I'm still rounded shoulders and no posterior, you know, strength, then who cares? You're still not going to be able to, you know, fire the gun.
Exactly.
So I got a quick question. As we're talking about the, Bubba always says the 2-to-1 ratio, the push-pull type thing. So, like, if I'm over at the weight room, say I'm bench pressing, say I'm doing, like, a heavyweight, five sets of three at 315, but then I go over and do, like, the TRX rows, like each time I do a bench press, you know, I could do kind of like a circuit training. So then I do like 10. Does that count since I'm doing 3 reps on bench press, but I'm doing 10 on the TRX rows, but it has to be, you're thinking 2 completely different exercises mm-hmm. or is it like need to
so
be
you
equal?
You could do TRX rows, but then you would need to throw in something like reverse flies, for instance, just to throw an exercise out there, 2 exercises, 2 pulls for every one push, 2 pull exercises for every one push exercise.
What are your thoughts, Marcus?
I totally agree with that, but I think what you're trying to get at is the dosage of it. Is that what you're trying to get
right,
at as well?
Right, because if I'm doing only 3 bench press, but mm-hmm. I'm doing 9, 10, 12 of the other one, does it not count as twice as much?
I think I'm going to say no, because I think you've got to get the 2 different pulls in there. Not double your pull reps to your push. I think you've got to change it. My personal opinion is you got to change it up and get 2 different exercises.
Okay, fair enough.
I still think the reps matter, but I think it's in a perfect world, 2 different exercises, if that makes sense.
Matthew, thoughts?
Yeah, I kind of agree with that. Going on about the two exercises, I kind of see that with belong with. So I'm more often now when I'm looking at the exercise, especially with the posterior side, I'm more looking at reps, more exercises, and kind of higher rep kind of thing.
But I'm just going to play devil's advocate. What if we do? Yep. What if you're looking at the anterior portion and you're looking at more endurance on that part, and then you're going to focus more on the strength part with the posterior stuff, so lower reps on the back. I mean, because that's technically what we want to do is strengthen mm-hmm. the back.
Right.
I mean, yeah, you want to go ahead and get that pump or whatever, you know, for the front. But functionally, we want to strengthen the back. So I would say what you're saying, but kind of flip it. Like, you would want to maybe strengthen the back, right? Or do more of eight reps, three, four sets of eight versus doing shorter on the front, you know? What are y'all thoughts on that?
I'm not gonna argue. I'm gonna say it. There's no bad answer as long as you're addressing
as long as you,
you know, because I think we can argue all day. Well, I think, you know, again, my personal philosophy is two exercises.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, it'd be fun to play around with this, say two exercises versus double the reps. What's the difference?
What's the difference? Yeah.
You know, that'd be fun to look at, but I think something's better than nothing.
Yeah.
You know, unless it's done wrong.
As long as you're just addressing that fact. Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and so, you know, again, we all have our favorites, mm-hmm. you know, but are we doing something, you know, what are we doing for glute ham for, you know, lower extremity stuff? Yeah. We better be doing something. Maybe not. I'm not doing the same exercises that Matthew would do or that you would do, but I'm doing exercises, mm-hmm. right? And so at least we're addressing it, which is the start. And that's further ahead than a lot of people.
Yeah, the education part is the first thing we need to kind of address. But
yeah.
I also think sometimes it depends on who you're working with, your type of, I think, patient. In my experience, I've worked with a lot of like overhead, softball, and baseball, and the posterior side, I'm trying to get them strong, but I'm looking at more as like functionally strong,
mm-hmm.
like kind of finding that 10 rep max or 10 to 15 rep max and kind of getting them to that point. Is normally what I think sometimes when we're looking at strength, I think it all depends on kind of what your patient is. If you're working with an athlete or just your weekend warrior type person.
Yeah, and I totally agree with that. You have to see what type of athlete you're dealing with. Of course, swimmers, you're going to need more endurance. Your pitchers, you're just going to be that quick power that you'll need, you know, over and over and over again. So as long as you're addressing the type of athlete, you know, what they're doing, right? I feel like you can get your dosage, you can play in your dosage a little bit more.
And I think we also, and again, we're jumping the gun, but we're not. In a couple of weeks, we'll talk about it. But, and it's the wrong word, but you can't forget the core, and you really can't forget the lower extremity. Because if they're all not strong and they're all not functioning together, doesn't matter how good your posterior chain is and your upper extremity, you're still going to suck.
Yeah, you definitely need that mobility as well.
Yeah.
You know, if I'm an overhead athlete in a ground-based sport and I can't transfer the ground forces up, then it doesn't matter.
Properly, yeah.
Right? Swimming's a little different, so your core really is almost your ground for your swimming. And so my core, which is a bad term, but core stability, we can argue that again. Mm-hmm. So, but if I don't have that, then it doesn't matter, you know. And so all those things have to work together. Why do we put a pitcher on the DL for a bad toe?
Because you need that.
You've got to be able to transfer, and if we can't transfer, we change our mechanics, something's going to give.
Yeah.
And so, you know, we know it's a total body process to have a good upper extremity function in an overhead athlete.
Yeah, I would totally agree with you. It's when we are doing – well, the way we do our evaluations at our clinic, we look at the actual cause of the cause. You know, you come in with elbow pain, we're not just going to treat your elbow. We're going to look at the shoulder. We're going to work up the train. We're going to look at the shoulder. We're going to look at the scapula. We're going to look at thoracic rotation. And if they're lacking, you have a pitcher that can't follow all the way through because he's a right-handed and his left rotation, he does his left rotation, you know, thoracic-wise sucks, then – like you said, that transfer of power, of force, is going to go through that thoracic. There'll be issues. It's going to put more stress on the shoulder blade. It's going to put more stress on the shoulder, and it's going to end up not going through that hand, but putting more pressure on that elbow.
Right. Right. Then how much have you abused it by how many innings have you pitched and all the other things that go with it? So, yeah. I think one of the things that's when we talk about anatomy that I've learned at being an old guy – and I really got lucky working for Dr. Lowe when this really all kind of clicked, is to me there's three levels of anatomy, if you will. There's textbook anatomy, there's clinical anatomy, and there's surgical anatomy. And in my opinion, if you can get to where you can view all three, you're a way better clinician in the long run. And people always argue, why does the surgery matter? The surgery matters a lot because, number one, as an athletic trainer, we got to be able to explain to our athlete what was done. But to be able to do that, we got to understand what's in there mm-hmm. and what was wrong. And if I can look at something surgically and I can go back from there and say, okay, clinically in an eval, and go back from there and say textbook wise, I can eliminate a lot of crap I don't need to deal with in mm-hmm. an evaluation, right? I don't need to do 400 tests because a good history and understanding my anatomy, I can rule out a lot of things. And now, during that eval, if it doesn't add up, now I start adding those back in. Mm-hmm. But I don't need to go look at X, Y, and Z when I could have gotten by with A through D, you know? And so, and again, that's my personal opinion, and, but that being able to take those three and put them all together, it really changed things for me as far as how I do an evaluation and what, you know, what they tell me when I'm thinking. Because you can say, okay, well, in theory, the whole posterior side shouldn't be a problem. We're looking, you know, maybe slap a little bit posterior, but, you know, bank hard or one of these things. And so we're not too worried about this unless things don't add up.
Mm-hmm. I totally agree with you on that, because some, especially when it comes to having a pain generator, a lot of people come in like, oh, I have, you know, posterior shoulder pain. And it could be something going on posteriorly with, you know, muscles or the capsule and things like that. I mean, you know, capsule posterior mobility. But sometimes that's the way that they actually go into the actual shoulder.
Right.
So surgically, it's nothing that's an issue. It's just, hey, that's just kind of where they went in.
That's got to heal. Yeah.
You know, they sewed that part back up, and that's why you had that kind of pain. And we kind of dive too deep, and we're like, hey, it's this and that and this, and it's something super simple like that. If you knew that surgical procedure and what he actually did, that's kind of eliminates, you know, what you really need.
Right.
To
you don't need to go watch 100 rotator cuff repairs, you know, to understand that. But I think the more you can go in and view, the way easier it is to understand what all was done, knowing, oh, you're right, they take this angle to fix this.
Exactly.
You know?
Exactly.
And being able to then translate that back to the patient to say, well, look, you need to understand, look, where are all your poke holes? You know, that you're going to have pain right there, you know,
scar
including
tissue can build up. No,
right,
science,
all those things, all that went into that. So, yeah.
All right, so before we get to the tips and tricks, Marcus, I see you're drinking the hoist water hydration I have out for you. What do you think about the, was that watermelon?
It's a watermelon flavor. That's pretty good.
Pretty good.
I've never had it. I didn't know that it was
flavored.
Until I drank it, I was kind of like, ooh. I was like, this is watermelon. I know what it tastes like. I've never experienced that before.
My favorite is the orange, and hoist is kind of partnered with the Sports Medicine Broadcast, and so, you know, they send me some so that I can make sure I have it for you guys that are here, adding value to us as athletic trainers. And then also there's some benefits for people who order using the code DSMB. Some of those orders will be matched up to like 4 cases, so if you order from there, but you can also check them out. So again, they'll be having some stuff for our NATM giveaway, but we're gonna get to tips and tricks. So Marcus has done a fantastic job going over the anatomy, and obviously Bubba always knows something about something. So
just ask me, I'll tell you.
All right, Matthew, you got any tips and tricks for identifying muscles, bones, ligaments, tendons, and the shoulder?
Oh boy, tips and tricks. I think sometimes when I get asked that, how I find stuff is I kind of just go back and what I learned, kind of go back to my undergrad, what I learned in school, because that's kind of where I learned most of my tips and tricks. And one thing I use, for example, is like the rotator cuff. Is I basically just think of the SSIT, just sit, and that kind of, just those acronyms kind of things. If you can somehow, whatever acronym works for you, like that one always works for me, subcap, supra, infra, and then teres minor. That's kind of one tip and trick I use for the rotator cuff. And I forgot kind of how you just lay your fingers out, just kind of right on that humeral head is kind of how sometimes I always find those kind of things mm-hmm. for the rotator cuff.
Now, that's definitely one thing that I use as well. And another way that you can do it to kind of expose more of that rotator cuff, those rotator cuff tendons, is actually put their arm in a little bit more extension. So mm-hmm. have the, you know, you passively bring them back, and then you can actually palpate and say, hey, you know, how's this feeling? Is this tender? Things like that. So kind of extending that arm and exposing more of those rotator cuff tendons is a nice little trick that we do during evaluation. Finding bicep tendon, you know, you put your finger, your thumb, kind of where you think that kind of greater trochanter is, put them in 90-90, and then you just kind of externally rotate and internally rotate back and forth, and you'll feel greater trochanter, you know, lesser trochanter, just kind of, and that'll be right in between that. Once you kind of feel those two little humps, right in between, that'll be your bicep tendon, and then that way you can kind of use your palpation skills and kind of track down, hey, this is kind of bothersome with them, on top of, you know, your MMTs and things like that.
All right, so going from the bicep tendon, because I think that one is typically pretty easy to identify. So where would you go next in identifying? Because I see the picture you have here in the show notes, again, sportsmedicinebroadcast.com/shoulder anatomy. Marcus did a fantastic job of putting in show notes and just things to help us there remember and review. But he's got a picture of a hand on top of the humerus, and I think the thumb is where the subscapularis would be, but obviously you can't put your hand right on top of somebody's
subscap. Yeah,
yeah, they're humerus just like that. So talk to me a little bit about, you found the bicipital groove, you found the where the bicep tendon is. So where are you going to poke next, and what are you finding?
So if you have subscap, we can start there. Subscap is going to be on the anterior portion of that shoulder blade. So I'd bring them out into kind of 90-90 abducted, and then you're going to take, let's say you're looking at the patient's left shoulder. You're going to take your left hand, put it against that thoracic, and you can just kind of slowly inch your way, just kind of follow the curve of that of the ribs. And then you can actually get in between that shoulder blade, and that you can actually see and feel that subscap. It's going to be super uncomfortable. But then you can compare it to the other side. Hey, does that feel? And that's how you can kind of, you know, kind of feel. That's what I kind of dive into. And if it's a soft tissue thing we need to work on, then we do a subscap soft tissue massage, and we're working on that. Another, of course, we'll kind of go to the posterior side and trying to feel some, if there's any, you know, teres minor or teres major, any kind of tendons on the back that we can kind of palpate and see if that kind of flares them up. I think that's about it as far as kind of palpation wise. You know, your coracoid, that's always going to be kind of tender there.
I think for me, where do you go next is based off what's going on.
Yeah.
You know, again, yeah, knowing your anatomy in the three ways, if you tell me, A, why am I going to Z?
Mm-hmm.
I'll argue I need to start most directly and then branch out from there as things don't make sense. I don't think you work global to focal.
Mm-hmm.
You know, even on a knee, where is it sore? On the inside. Oh, joint line or MCL is where we're going, right? We're not going, mm-hmm, oh, let's look at the hamstrings first. No. Mm-hmm. We're going to the spot and working out from there if things don't make sense. And I think that's my personal opinion. That's how I do it. So we've got pain here. Okay, let me start there. You know, you're not really sore there. So let me move over to the other structures that are nearby, and let's go from there. And that gives me my blueprint, kind of my map of where we're going.
And I'm kind of glad you said that, because you're, like you said, you're starting in that one position and you're going out. So you have pain with adduction coming across, like shoulder adduction. It's kind of pinching right there in the anterior part. So I'm going to look at that AC joint. I'm going to look at the distal and proximal part of the actual sternum, of the clavicular. So we're going to go all the way down to the sternum. Okay, there's movement going on there,
mm-hmm,
right? It's going to glide. It's not a lot, but it's going to glide in the anterior, posterior. It actually kind of rotates a little bit. So I'm feeling to see if there's any hypomobility, or it could be a hypermobility that's causing the pain in the actual shoulder. So we're going to go spread out. You know, we're going to check AC joint, see how that's moving. We're going to check the SC joint, see how that's moving. It's like you said, it's just not that one area, right? And then, of course, you're also going to check the mobility of the scapula, making sure that it's rotating. It's so many patients that come in with shoulder pain and, you know, just picking their arm up. And if you actually have them pick their arm up, they're like, oh, it hurts. And then you say, okay, I'm going to assist your shoulder blade as you go up. Let's try it again. And then it immediately, okay, it feels a whole lot better, or it's really no pain at all. And that tells you right there, okay, that's one issue we need to address. Mm-hmm. Do some scapular moves to kind of get that mobility back. So yeah, it's not just that one spot. Just because they have it in the anterior part, like you said, what is the cause of the cause? Like, what is causing the pain, right?
Well, and I know we'll get into it in Val, but let's just say my shoulder or elbow's hurting, and the PCP that referred them to therapy never cleared their C-spine.
Oh, yeah.
And they got a disc, and it's not even, you know, a lateral or medial epicondylitis that they wrote it for, it or whatever, rotator cuff tear. you know, they've got a disc problem, and you've always got, you know, especially in upper extremity, no matter if it's wrist or whatever, you got to clear the C-spine.
You got to clear the C-spine. There's so many different cases where they have ridiculous pain, you know, the numbness, the tingling in their hands. You have to check that C-spine out. It might not even be the actual C-spine. It could be the first rib just kind of bumping into that brachial plexus a little bit, mm-hmm. just because it's elevated. So, I mean, there's different – you have to look at the person globally, functionally, and not just zero down on just one spot, right?
And to me, again, it goes back to knowing the anatomy. You don't mm-hmm. got to know it intimately. I mean – We're not doing surgery, you know, and we're not reading MRIs and dictating reports, but you got to know it because, again, hey, I'm getting numbness and tingling. Well, all right, we got to clear C-spine. That's clear. Well, we got to look at thoracic outlet. All right, we got to clear that.
Yep.
You know, we got to work from one spot out. So the first spot I'm going to go with numbness and tingling, I'm going to the neck.
Yep.
And that's not the neck, all right? Got to look at thoracic outlet. No, it's not that. All right, now this gets fun, you know. Now we've got to really start drilling into what it could be if we can figure it out.
So then again, that what you just said, Bubba, is exactly why I wanted to kind of go over the shoulder, because so many people say start with the anatomy. That's what you know, start with the anatomy. Well, what if I don't really know the anatomy? That's why I wanted to, again, go over the review. You know, obviously I can go back to the textbook, but that only translates so much. And so what can I put my hands on? And I know over and over again, you said you got the three different types of anatomy, the textbooks, the clinical, and then mm-hmm. the surgical anatomy. And going to surgery is difficult, more difficult now than it used to be.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just one of those things you have to make an intentional effort to do. And, you know, you part of building that relationship with your team doctor or whatever it is, your local orthopedic. But let's talk a little bit more about just ways to help identify. And again, this ties so much in with evaluation, and we're going to talk more about that later. But I want, again, as much as we can, focus just on ways to identify the anatomy. So any other things you got to help focus on identifying the anatomy?
Let's see. So we can start with kind of positional faults. You can see where the scapula is placed. Normally, you know, the inferior border is going to be kind of around T7 area. Superior border should be kind of around T1, T2. Then that kind of the spine of the scapula should be about T3-ish. Okay. So first thing, just observation-wise, see how they're sitting. See where they place. Are they... And then also, you should be about 3 or 4 fingers from the spinous process to the actual scapula. So if you're seeing that it's a huge gap in between T-spine and the medial border of that scapula, that's telling you right there that there's going to be some type of functional limitation. So visually, you kind of want to just look at everything as a whole. As far as just the original placement or where it's actually starting.
I think a good thing to do, if you can find the right guinea pig, and one of your boys would be more than willing, get their shirt off of them or get them in shorts, draw. Find it, mark it.
Yep.
Draw it. And then all of a sudden you'll be like, oh, that makes sense now when you can see it that way. You know, find the, you know, mark the AC joint. You know, palpate the coracoid, find the biceps tendon, mark it somehow, whether that's a line on each side of it, so you kind of know this is where it's running, whatever it is, draw it with a marker and you know, graffiti them up and you know, kind of put dots where the border of the scapula is, and kind of, you know, looking at those and being able to visualize this, how the scapula is sitting, and if you could do both sides, because all of a sudden you'd be like, ooh, they're winging, couldn't see it without the marks. But then you can take them off and look at your kinko. Now I can see it perfectly,
mm-hmm.
you know. And so I think, you know, if they'll let you mark on them, you know, I mean, I do it all the time myself. If you've got a bad knee injury, I'm marking where the distal pulse is, so I can go find it again. But why aren't we, you know, let's learn anatomy the same way. Mark it with something that's going to come off, not a Sharpie, you know, like I would use on that, but that you can visualize it. I mean, it mm-hmm. works great.
And not just using just one person, everybody's different. So right. Different type of body types. Of course, everybody wants to go to the more, you know, skinnier person, so you can kind of see what the anatomy is. But go and get you somebody that's a little bit thicker, you know, got some, you know, body tissue, so you can really test your skills, because not everybody is going to come in easy to kind of.
They can all swole like you, Marcus?
Yeah, yeah. No, they don't all come in. No, I'm just kidding. No. But, yeah, you just kind of, as far as practice-wise, that's one thing we did in school. That's one thing we did in our fellowship. We made sure that you touched every type of body type, right?
Mm-hmm. That's good. I think
one more.
Go ahead, Matthew.
Oh, go ahead. I think one thing, just looking at, like, if you're, like a student or, like, somebody that's just coming out in their practice, I know that one thing that worked for me and that worked, it's kind of what I learned in undergrad, is we had this book. It's called, I think it's called, like, Trail Guide to the Body.
Trail Guide to the Human Body. Yep, phenomenal.
Yeah, is that what it is?
Yeah.
I really recommend that one to, like, AT students or PT students that I come into contact with, because that book goes over every muscle and it gives you every position on how to, you know, palpate or find that muscle. It gives them prone, it gives you sideline. And I think all experience levels, I think you can use that, because I think that's where the guinea pigs and just more practice comes in. And, like, if you really don't understand it, then bring that book out and it shows you, and it gives, like, a picture of that, like, of just a normal textbook body. And I think it gives you a little bit, like, you can try to translate to the actual person.
Yeah, no, the Trail Guide to the Human Body is probably the millennials version of our anatomy coloring book.
Oh, man, I was just about to say that.
You know,
probably, that coloring book saves wonders. You make a copy of it, and then you just color it once, twice, and just kind of follow that.
The Trail Guide to the Human Body is phenomenal.
Yeah.
I was just about to say that coloring book. That.
Yeah.
All right, so just a quick Amazon search, Trail Guide to the Body, How to Locate Muscles, Bones, and More. It's $60, spiral bound. I will have a link to that there in the show notes, but Trail Guide to the Human Body, so I'm going to have to check that out. But I really like the idea of drawing on the boys. I've done that in sports medicine class, but it's pretty limited. You can't just have everybody kind of rip their shirt off, but there are guys that would be willing to, you know, take their shirt off and that kind of thing. And so that's a really good idea. For me teaching the class, I get to practice on them and remember by just drawing on them. So we've gone over all the anatomy. We've talked about some tips and tricks. And now let's talk about just some of the weird stuff that you have seen or you've had to identify or rule out. It's like, okay, well, you know, I've heard of rib resection or whatever it is. And so when you're palpating, well, that feels really weird, that kind of thing. So just some of the weird things you have seen in shoulder anatomy.
It's weird and challenging. One case, it's adhesive capsulitis. Mm-hmm. I can't, and you know, frozen shoulder. It is one of the trickiest things. It's tricky to treat. You know, it's easy to kind of
diagnose it, yeah.
But the prognosis, it's too wide. It's too long. It can vary from a couple months to a year. And the treatment wise, it's, do you be passive with it? Do you be aggressive with it? You know, there's a lot of research on it. They're still trying to figure out what is the true reason on what happens. I mean, other than post-op, you know,
is it
not moving it.
Is it
yeah. But the actual just people that just pop up, wake up one morning like, hey, I can't move my shoulder.
Well, the problem is you could put them under an anesthesia, manipulate them, and then they're going to wake up and 3 days later be frozen again because for whatever reason, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Even putting them on a CPM, they gradually, I'm losing my motion.
Yeah.
Why?
Don't know. And they did some research on it, and they're saying, you know, it's more hormonal, especially
Common in females.
Females, menopause, things like that. But, I mean, even males, they said it's either, you know, stress levels, it could be diet. I mean, it's the list goes on what's actually the cause of it. But passive, I mean, the treatment-wise on it, it's, like I said, I've had people that are like, hey, just push my hand back, push my arm back, be aggressive with it. And, you know, you're aggressive with it, it works sometimes, it doesn't work. Okay, be passive with it. You know, it works sometimes, it doesn't. And what really makes it more difficult is actually they can't lift their arm up. So then it jumps into I'm using my upper trap, firing my upper trap over and over and over just so I can pick my arm up and grab something out. So then you're fighting that case as well as upper trap, lower trap. Right, because they're doing a lot of compensation, so it's a tricky one for me as far as when they come into the clinic. And then emotionally, you know, psychologically, you're dealing with, you know, every time I come to PT, it's painful, or hey man, I just want this to be done with. So it takes a lot of patience, and it's probably one of the since I can't grab it, you know, right. the concept of them. Because what's actually happened is that those that capsule is just shrinking, and it shrinks, and it does not want to move. And as far as evaluating it and diagnosing it, your lack of external rotation is the first thing that goes. So they're going to have the greatest limitations with external rotation. When you start to see that, and then it goes into abduction, they can't abduct as well, and then they can't flex. The flexion will probably be the most range of motion that they'll have, but you take that that arm in external rotation, and it stops. You try to take it in abduction, and it stops, and you take it in flexion, and it stops. That's going to be most likely your frozen shoulder. So it's one of the trickiest ones, man. I super, super weird for me sometimes.
Matt, Bubba?
Go ahead, Matthew.
I think a weird one. I mean, we've all heard of the thoracic outlet syndrome, but I think it's still weird to me. In my first year as a grad student, I came across a softball pitcher that had it. And that was kind of when I really learned more about it, is that it can be neurological, or it can be because what happened is like this girl was constantly having radiating numbness and tingles down to her fingers. And I'm like, well, this is what I think it is. Kind of took her out of softball. Well, one night she woke up in the middle of the night and her arm was blue. Well, her arteries kind of got pinched, so she had to kind of go get almost like emergency type surgery, where they had to, I believe, take out her subclavian, which is a muscle that a lot of people forget. It was kind of tight. Then they had to dissect the distal fourth of her first rib, which after that surgery is kind of weird to feel. That's why I would have my students palpate that one. But that one was always a weird one to me, because that's always the one that I learned about in undergrad. I was like, oh, I'm probably never going to see it. Well,
see it, yeah.
two years out, my first injury that I basically saw in my as a grad student was that one, and it was definitely something. And it kind of showed me not everything was black and white. Like you read about the stuff in the textbook, but all of a sudden there's going to be that one case where something like that happens, where a patient comes to you and their arms, you know, doesn't have proper circulation. So that's definitely one that always pops to my mind when somebody asks me, what's the weirdest thing you've seen at the shoulder? I'm like, well, that's normally the one that's the weirdest thing that I've seen.
Now, we do deal in a lot more gray than a lot of professions, you know, in that regard. But
yeah,
you know, for me, it's the most challenging one for me is the multidirectional instability person, because no matter what you do, they're not going to do better. and you're still trying to get them to where they can function and play. But I think the weirdest one I've seen is an upper extremity compartment syndrome. So that was pretty interesting. But, you know, similar to, you know, lower extremity, they open it up and free the pressure and let it go. I think they ended up doing a first rib resection over time, because it was all kind of interrelated, but they weren't a true TOS. They were a compartment at the time. So, mm-hmm. you know, that was like, they were what? Huh? You know, but... Yeah.
Yeah, that first rib will get you sometime.
Yeah, and I don't know. I mean, you guys, the ones I've seen with TOS are typically not skinny. They're kind of like me, bull-necked, a little thicker, you know, because there's less space. Everything's kind of jammed in there. I've never seen a giraffe-necked skinny person get diagnosed with TOS, you know. So, not saying it can't happen, but.
Yeah, this girl was definitely fit, but being that she was a softball pitcher – it was her pitching side. So I don't know how many, like every softball player I come to contact with, because that side they pitch on, they are, if you just look at them, you can see you are so right dominant, because I can see you are so bigger on that side.
Right.
That's the side you're constantly using.
Right.
And I think that definitely played a part into it, because her right side was so much more, I want to say more muscular than compared to her contralateral side.
Right.
She was definitely a fit girl. It was just that side.
All right, any other tips, tricks, thoughts on anatomy of the shoulder as we continue next week into evaluation and then the week after Thanksgiving, at least when this is being recorded, on rehabilitation? Marcus, anything else?
I've noticed, and what I do a lot in the clinic as far as helping with stability of the scapula is more closed-chained scapular stability exercises, mm-hmm. Whether that be and then you're trying to do it. And it's tricky because you're trying to be a little bit more creative because the serratus is really going to be more active when the arm is kind of a little bit over about 110. So exercises that activate those muscles when you need them the most is tricky. So I'll have them do bear crawls, but they're reverse bear crawls. So you're actually pushing away. We do a lot of, I call them, you know, drunken bar, where you're got a kettle, you have a bar in your hand, you have a kettlebell on one side, and then a 10-pound kettlebell and a 5-pound in the back. So you're holding that over your arm, creating stability within that shoulder blade. So it's tricky on trying to keep it close chained as much as possible, but that's one thing I pretty much do a lot in the clinic. I mean, you know, you got your step ups and things like that, close chain wise, but that's what we kind of do a little bit most in our clinic when it comes to our, you know, our baseball players, because they need that stability.
Close chain in the upper extremity is hard because we don't walk on our hands,
exactly,
you know, and so you gotta figure out ways to do that. You know, and we'll talk about it more, but I think one of the things I saw is like stacking up plates at different levels, and you have to do push-ups, like one hand's on the floor, one hand's on the plate, mm-hmm. push-up. Next hand's on the plate, the other's on a different level of plate, so you're kind of unstable at the same time. Just little ways to do mm-hmm. that, stair step or step up, or push-ups and stuff. So I think, you know, as we talked about it, there's no shame in going back periodically and reviewing your anatomy.
Yeah,
I think we get away from it. I know it, screw it, and all of a sudden, like, wait a minute, where's that insertion mm-hmm. again? What's the action?
Yeah.
So there's nothing wrong with, I don't know, however you want to do it, one joint a month for, you know, look at it for an hour one day. I don't care, whatever you want to do, but go back and refresh your memory,
especially on those biomechanics.
Yeah, you know, I mean,
yep.
And as I've talked about before, like with the kid that had the stroke, I, you know, cardiac stuff isn't sexy, but we probably ought to remember how the heart functions, and you know, the blood goes from here to here to here to here to here. You know, same thing. Refresh yourself with that every now and then, just so it's in the back of your head and not, you know, buried under a bunch of other clutter that's in there. You know, you don't have to. It's not a long, week-long immersive study. It's, you know, 30 minutes, an hour, and be done with it.
And whip out my coloring book.
Trail guide, man. Way better.
Coloring book.
Matt, final tips, tricks?
Yeah, I think the final thing is what I normally tell people about the shoulder is make sure you always look at the shoulder as a whole. Sometimes I kind of think of the shoulder as like a cause and effect thing. Like, for example, anterior is, you know, being the cause of the pain. But then what's the effect? It's normally on the posterior side, like mm-hmm. what's weak, what's tight. Mm-hmm. So most of the time I just tell people, look at the shoulder as a big thing. Most of the time it's going to be a thing. That one thing might not be hurting you, but it's causing the second thing, which causing you, causing your thing. And I think some people just get in the habit of just looking at the one thing, but not looking at potentially the larger problem. Mm-hmm. But obviously we're more in about, I want to stop this pain. So what's really kind of being the cause that's making that effect?
All right, so I know watching live, I had at least Craig Lewin, John Harmon, Tilla Henderson, Brandy Neely, Philip Tucker, and I know that there are more. I just couldn't catch all of them. So thanks for watching live and tuning in. And actually, Matt joined this one because he's interested in starting his own podcast. And once he gets that up and going, I'll have him back on here and we'll kind of discuss what his is and about and that kind of thing. And so, Matt, I appreciate you joining in and helping and desiring to help athletic trainers grow. And so his would be similar, talking to doctors or kind of taking one topic and getting, you know, a doctor's, a physical therapist, an athletic trainer perspective kind of idea. But that's still in the works. So Matt, I look forward to hearing from you again in the future.
Yes. Thank you very much for having me on today. I had quite the experience. It was a lot of fun. Thank you guys.
Stay warm.
Thank you. Oh yeah.
Thank you. I'll do my best.
Matt, somebody wants to get a hold of you. What's going to be the best way?
You can find me on Twitter. I believe it's ATScoop1. That's kind of my more professional-based Twitter handle. I'm also on Instagram. I believe that one's just ATScoop. But find me on Twitter, ATScoop1. I should be right up there.
All right, Bubba. Someone wants to find you.
You know, I don't know what it is.
ATCLAT Bubba.
Yeah.
On Twitter. All right, so find Bubba that way. He doesn't tweet very often, but he catches the messages or whatever. So if you mention him or contact him or direct message him, then he'll get a hold of you that way. So, Marcus, I'm going to get a hold of you.
Oh, the best way, you can buy email. So you can go mf Knox, like Fort Knox, K-N-O-X. So mfknox@houstonmethodist.org.
And then, of course, you can go to sportsmedicinebroadcast.com/shoulder anatomy. Again, sportsmedicinebroadcast.com/shoulder anatomy. And again, we talked about the hoist hydration. Marquez had it here. Bubba had some.
It's delicious.
if you come and you're a guest on the show, then I'll have some for you. If you order some, then you get a discount by using the code THESMB. So check that out. And they're going to be, again, with us at NATA as we're in Vegas. And then the resource that they mentioned, either the anatomy coloring books or the trail guide of the human body. Again, I'll have a link there at sportsmedicinebroadcast.com/shoulder anatomy. For Jeremy, Marcus, Bubba, and Matthew, that is a wrap. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.